This is Ricky Simons, the voice of Gurr from Invader Zim, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Woo!
Hi, I'm Red Kendall.
And I'm Paragon, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Episode 70, Identities, Secret, Private, and Public.
Surprise! It's us!
Yes, it's us! I'm Professor Allen!
And I'm Em!
Did you fall for our trick? It was us, in our secret identities!
It was us the whole time!
Because, you know, almost every superhero has one. I know you're thinking, a cape?
No.
No
capes.
The secret identity, the civilian life. It's such a common part of superhero comics that we don't really even talk about it.
But we should. And in this episode, we're going to.
But first, we should explain our secret identities.
I had totally forgotten that we even had these until you messaged me out of the blue, and I was thrown directly back into, like, 2016.
Because back in the long ago days, when we were just getting started, we got a nice care package from listener, artist, and online buddy Andy Kapelish. Based on some Facebook or Twitter thing. I think it was one of those...
those superhero ask meme thingies.
What color is your shirt, and name something on the table to your left or something. I ended up being Red Candle. You know, that ended up being my superhero name, so Andy sent a number of sketches our way, including a cover recreation of Batman introducing Robin, with the Golden Age Green Lantern introducing his new sidekick, the Red Candle. And he also included a sheet of sketches of the various iterations of this Red Candle. The Golden Age, pre-crisis, post-crisis, 0 hour.
Where he got the cool rad new name, Death Flicker. So good.
Which every letterist would have loved. And the new 52 version. I mean, this was genius.
It was brilliant. You had a full-blown alter ego OC with like an entire...
70 years of history.
An entire 70-year fake publishing history. It's stunning.
And then you took your name, Paragon. An episode literally...
eight-ish years in the making. Because the Paragon thing was for a NaNoWriMo that I was going to do that was, I don't remember which year it was, but it was specifically like a superhero-themed goal.
And
I
got National Novel Writing Month, yep.
Got a few thousand words down, but that was back when I'm pretty sure we first talked about superhero prose.
Yes.
Which again.
It's all coming back.
It's all the wheel in the sky keeps on turning.
Because we are coming up on our 10th anniversary.
Wow.
Look, I know that I'm old, but here's the thing. You're getting there too.
Yeah, I'm also kind of old. I have coworkers who were born in years that start with a 2.
Oh,
and I'm not really coping great with that. Gonna level with you.
So we will talk all about secret identities. But first, or since that was first, this... But second, feedback.
Again, a lot of these are going to be a little bit old because it's been a while since we've done one of these, trying to get back into the swing of things. But our buddy Vera Weil reached out a couple times over Twitter during the pandemic to say, if I have any semblance of sanity left today, it is because of Improvised Weapons Cast and the Short Box Showcase.
Yes.
Man. If there was anything that was just welcome to the COVID-19 pandemic, whatever thread that you can like tether your sanity
hold
on to that so tight. And I am glad that while I was spiraling into my Dragon Age obsession, we could provide another lifeline for some of our friends.
Now, this is another one that fell between the cracks. This is from Stella's senior assistant to the associate intern, Tom Pannaries, writing in on a conversation that me and Mr. Bailey and Mr. Spatero had a number of years ago about comic book retailing. But obviously, that is something we've talked a lot about here. So
yep, the last
topic
few episodes, so.
Fits. So, Professor Paul and Shag, I thought the episode was informative in a way that most discussions about the business side of our hobby often aren't. I've had the fortune of living near comic shops since 1984 and have been a regular customer since about 1990. I stay loyal to my LCS because I've never had a bad experience with those particular stores, just something that I know we all agree goes a long way. The same can be said for a few particular booths at the comic convention I go to every year. I look for them because the staff is friendly, things are priced fairly, and the cheap bins are mostly alphabetized. And jumping in here, let me say that mostly alphabetized is all we can really ask for. If you just have the A's together, the L's are somewhere in the middle, the S's towards the end, and the X's have the final box. Sorry, the X's have the final 17 boxes.
Yes.
Then that's really all we need. Tom continues, sadly, I know that keeping me as a customer isn't going to save my LCS. But I have noticed some of the things they do to get new customers and keep them coming back. There's a designated kids section right in the front of the store that they always keep well stocked. There's a huge discount trade paperback section, mainly Marvel because Marvel overprints everything.
Yes, they do.
Plus, they take full advantage of seasonal sales, free comic book day, and have partnered with the local library for some events.
Mm, that's the way to go.
Granted, I know I'm lucky to have an LCS that is so proactive because I've been to the types of stores where you really don't feel welcome because the elitists laugh at you or the cigar-smelling old man running the place wants those damn kids out of his store and off his lawn. I also worry about the state of the industry as well. I've enjoyed some recent DC comics, but haven't touched a Marvel book in years. All of the restarts and reboots of Marvel titles in the last decade makes it very hard to organize a collection or even try to sell it on eBay. I seriously had to go to Mike's Amazing World last month just to make sure I had the correct volume of Wolverine listed in an auction. You shouldn't have to do that. All the best, Tom. One thing on that made me think of probably the best store in Central Ohio, not the one we go to very often, the big store, Laughing Ogre. It's well-staffed, it's big, it's bright, it's clean, it does everything right.
Yes.
Except to have cheap discount bins. But one of the things they do right when you walk in is the kids section.
Yes.
That's the very first thing you find, or it's the last thing you see on your way out. In terms of store layout, mm-hmm. that is probably one of the best things that a comic store can do to be welcoming to youngest, the future generations of comic book readers.
Absolutely. And another one about an old subject, this one from Sir Iowa's Joe. Tweeted out a poll for how he should organize his comics. That was one of his COVID projects. And Tom Pannaries responded, whatever you end up doing, it is required that you write Shortbox Showcase and tell them all about it. Okay. I love our friends. I love our friends.
Yeah, we do get tagged into every conversation about organizing one's comics. That was it's kind of our thing for a while, wasn't it?
It's our thing now, I would actually say. Specifically for last episode, where we talked once again about the comic book industry and also announced our countdown to final short box, Sir Martin of Gray said, it's great to hear two of my favorite smart folk yapping about comics once more. Congrats to M on the new job.
Yay, agreed.
Thank you.
Now, we can tell it's been a little while since we recorded our last episode because your new job is now about 18 months.
Yes.
You are rapidly gaining seniority around that place.
Which, let me just say, also terrifying. But, you know, Carry on. I once took a job in a Knightsbridge bookshop, and it was great, until they decided I was just the person to join the upheaded notepaper department and deal with the super demanding aristos. Ugh. Okay, I have managed to dodge that one. Again. So far.
So far.
So far. I'm going for the vital competence as opposed to, like, over competence. You can't promote me because no one can do what I do. Don't put me in charge of anything because no one else knows how to do this. So fingers crossed.
You want to make yourself valuable.
Yes.
But not so that you're tempting them.
You have to make me do more. I'm
to
like,
make you do more. Yes.
No, no.
I love it. I love it.
Sir Martin continues, I'm not down with the idea of making all company IP from a certain point public domain. I fear we'd wind up with a lot of terrible fan fiction and maybe some good stuff. That's a fair concern.
Yeah.
As a DC and Marvel lifer, I like having an official universe for each. If people are that creative, they can come up with their own characters and concepts to gain the company's attention, then be invited to work on the official IP and little by little change the big beasts. I agree that the Penguin Classics Marvel books are really nicely designed. And I get that Archie has the supermarket cash register displays sewn up with their own digests, but I don't understand why DC, with the marketing power of whoever owns them this week, can't publish cheap entry-level comics for kids featuring their biggest characters.
Yeah.
The eternal question. I'm sorry to hear that number 75 will be the final episode. Just make sure it comes with a plastic bag in it with a black armband. This joke is for Michael Bailey.
I can't believe that we didn't come up with the black armband joke.
I'm so mad.
This,
I am so mad.
This is pod shaming, Mart. Why are you doing this to us?
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. Because it just means that every year we need to re-release the episode with a new edition so that Michael will keep downloading it.
So he'll keep listening? Okay, good. It is going to be tough to get the hardcover version of this. I think it can be done.
I'll find a way. With my ins to the publishing industry.
Oh, yes. Now, Billy D. from The Brave and the Bob. It's a Bob Haney-centered podcast, in case you didn't know.
Excellent.
So it was great to hear us back. Really looking forward to these last few episodes. And I hope you get a grand send-off, as it is well-deserved. And former podcaster Michael Bradley disclosed the secret truth behind this all. Alan and M, as sad as I am to hear about the looming end of Shortbox Showcase, I think we all need to face the undeniable fact. Its days were numbered once it became the Jimmy Olsen Hate Podcast.
I didn't know this was going to be the Jimmy Olsen Hate Podcast.
It's always the Jimmy Olsen Hate Podcast. Still probably one of my greatest moments, I gotta say.
He's a boy witch doctor, you know.
I know! He's also a lizard man!
And many, many other things. Sincerely, relatively geeky's pal, Michael Bradley.
And you know what? You are a better pal and a confidant! So I'll take it.
And another Michael B. Podcasting's Michael Bailey wrote in as well. M and Professor Allen, I know that some people say giving feedback on feedback is a sin, but I'm going to chance it because I'm amused beyond belief that in between the last episode you released and this one, Warner Brothers changed hands.
Again.
It's almost comical. If they didn't seem to be going scorched earth on movies I was looking forward to, hashtag release Batgirl.
Yep.
I'm just going to make a couple of comments on the Batgirl movie that was shelved, which, no surprise, I had to make to our good friend Stella.
Yes.
In the aftermath of this news. One is just a comment that if corporate income taxes were lowered, there would be less incentive to do this. And two, this was the one that actually may have relieved Stella the most, and maybe this would apply to Michael and many other disappointed fans. Let's assume that the first Batgirl movie is a smash hit. Let's assume they then do a sequel, equally good. What storyline would the third movie have to be?
Killing Joke.
It would have to be the Killing Joke.
Yeah.
It's the most successful, most, you can say infamous, you can say terrible, you can say hurtful, you can say hateful, you can say whatever you want to. Sorry, Killer Moth. But the Killing Joke is the biggest story in her career. They would have to do it.
It is
eventually
the defining narrative moment for good and ill. And it would go to the big screen.
It would have to. So Michael, with hashtag release Batgirl, I'm just saying, be careful what you wish for.
That is kind of a monkey's paw.
It might not turn out the way you intended.
That we all would hope.
Back to podcasting's Michael Bailey. I'll address your big announcement in a moment. Before that, I wanted to say that I actually shouted yes as I was listening to M talk about how Deadpool and Harley Quinn have a lot in common. I felt that way for literally years, especially when both characters were at their apex at their respective companies. I like when M and I see eye to eye on things. Yeah, Mike, here's the thing. I have found that seeing eye to eye with M is a pretty good indicator that I'm correct.
And I am glad for you to feel seen. Michael, we are correct.
As for your announcement, as much as I would love for this show to go on forever, I'm also a big believer in people ending things on their terms. I'll miss the show and the enjoyment I've gotten from it, but I respect y'all's decision. I will be listening and feedbacking until the very end. Your obedient servant, Podcasting's Michael Bailey.
And our first guest ever, Sir Luke Giaconetti, had this to say. Professor and M, while I am disheartened to hear that the Shortbox Showcase will be coming to a close, I can take solace in the fact that, with 6 episodes to close it out, I can count on about 8 to 9 years of episodes going at the current rate. Hey now, I kid because I care. Well, you know what? Since you mentioned it, I will also pull back the curtain a little bit and say, we are recording this because Michael Hey Kids Comics came back, and I just was not going to let that stand.
No, no, no. I mean, well, I thought when Michael Leyland graduated college, moved away, got a real job and adult responsibilities, you know what this is like?
Mm-hmm.
I thought maybe Shortbox Showcase could stay ahead of Hey Kids Comics. But no, who has to come home for Christmas and record an episode with their dad?
And enjoy, I don't know, spending time talking about comics, recording it so people can listen to it. And then I was just like, well,
I guess we have to
I
now.
Guess we gotta too.
So Leyland's, you're on the clock now.
And thank you. Luke continues, in any event, I think as podcasters, once you go a certain period, you start thinking about the exit strategy. One doesn't want to simply pod fade into oblivion, but there is the fact that situations change, and we can't do this forever. I know that over Earth Destruction Directive, I've covered a good portion of the core content I had originally planned to set out and cover. How long will I continue? And what directions will I go? No idea. But it is the Rubicon which all podcasters must eventually approach. The fact is that you both have a plan that is a good sight better than most. For as long as the show lasts, I remain your devoted listener, Luke. Thank you, Luke.
Thanks to all our feedbackers, friends, and listeners. Y'all is our good buddies. So let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll talk
secret identities.
Can I get a tall chai?
And a large black coffee.
And I suppose you're here with no agenda, as per usual?
On the contrary, I'm here for comics.
I think I can help all of you. Hello, I'm the caffeinated Clinton Robison, and I host a podcast called Coffee and Comics. On this podcast, I summarize, review, and discuss comic book issues, stories, and related media, usually in the span of time it takes to have a cup of coffee. Sometimes I'm joined by a guest, and sometimes I'm flying solo. So pour the coffee, take a sip, and turn up the volume as you listen to the Coffee and Comics Podcast. Available on iTunes, Stitcher, and directly on coffeeandcomicspodcast.blogspot.com. And remember, this is where the comics are never too old and the coffee is never too cold.
And we're back.
One of the key elements, common tropes, of a superhero comic is the secret identity. We've taken for granted for almost 80 years that a comic book superhero needs to have a second identity. It's so common and so unexamined a trope that we thought we'd spend a few minutes examining it.
And we're going to be looking at this topic broadly from two different perspectives. One is internal to the comic book itself within the world, especially here in the modern age. Would a secret identity really be necessary, and how could you pull it off? And then the other is external to the world of the comic. More about the creative aspect, the writer's perspective, the genre perspective, conventions, and things like that. And that is, what's the literary function for the lead character having a secret identity in terms of the genre? Is a secret identity mandatory? And what does it add, or what complications does it create?
And we'll probably sort of hop back and forth between those two ideas, but I think those are sort of the two buckets that you have for discussion of secret identities.
And I'm going to throw out a term here that people may be aware of. This is always my thing, is I spend a lot of time in like fandom spaces where there is fandom-specific literary criticism. So I have literally no clue what terms and concepts are actually like real... like real literary criticism terms, and which ones are just sort of like useful slang. But for you and many of our other Sherlockian fans,
yes,
there is the concept of the Watsonian versus the Doyleist perspective, which is basically what this is as well. The explanation from Dr. Watson's perspective within the context of the narrative, why does this thing happen this way and what is the explanation for it? And it's, well, within the context of the parameters of the story, here's why. And then the one step back Doyleist perspective is, why did you do this? Why did this happen? What is the explanation for this? To which the answer is, because I'm writing a story.
I had a thought on this that I literally just had about 2 hours ago. I was listening to a Tolkien-related podcast, specifically talking about the movie adaptations, the Peter Jackson films. Their point was that Gimli was the character hardest done by the adaptation.
Yes.
That he really just became a comic relief character. Just the butt of the jokes. And they were trying to figure out why that happened. And they were looking at it from a Watsonian perspective. Why is this? Why have all the dwarves? What's happened to dwarf culture for the? And I was thinking of this from a Doyleist perspective. And that is, if you're Peter Jackson and you're looking at all the characters in this company, who do you, as Peter Jackson, most identify with? I've never heard him say this. He's a small, large, hairy man. I have a feeling that Peter Jackson was not making fun of Gimli. It was self-deprecating humor. And Gimli is the stand-in for Peter Jackson himself. That is my total hypothesis. I've never heard anyone say this. That is how I believe Gimli came to be how Gimli is in the films. A purely Doyleist perspective.
That is so insightful, especially because, reminder for myself, I really need to rewatch the making ofs because it's been like 7 years. This is the thing. Again, I had COVID derangement for a good long while, and now I want to go back to the other things that bring me joy. For example, the making of the Lord of the Rings 6-disc special features. But that was always the thing that I was like, I loved about the Lord of the Rings as a set is that all three scripts were written together, and it was basically the three writers.
Yes.
Like locked in a trailer for 15 months.
Start to finish. Yep.
And taking that context of how it was written into perspective, I think that makes total sense. Yeah. That's so insightful, Dad. You were so, yes, again, no confirmation, but yes, absolutely.
Talking about COVID stuff, and I think a lot of us either went hard into the things we were already into during that time with this quote-unquote free time that some of us found ourselves
floundering in,
or we said, I'm not doing anything from the before times. And I think that to some extent is what you were experiencing there. It's like, nope. That just reminds me of happy days. I mean, whatever was going on in your subconscious, I think that may be a touch of it. And now maybe you're ready again.
Yeah, I will say, did not watch Leverage for like all of 2021, right. Which for anyone who knows me, Michael Bailey, knows that going 12 months without watching a single episode of Leverage is an absolute cry for help.
Yeah, no. Well, as we move on to this topic, let me start by asking you this. Because as a society, as a world, we have just come out of, depending where you live, a 3-month to a 3-year experiment of dealing with people wearing masks in public. Has that experience changed your opinion on at least the realistic viability of disguising oneself via a mask? In other words, what was the impact of seeing everyone you know and love, and strangers as well, in masks?
I think what we learned from a lot of that was something that actually, in a weird way, kind of bolsters the mask situation, which is if you were wearing a face mask, you could still recognize people. Because the only thing that was visible is the stuff a superhero mask would cover up.
True.
Because that was the biggest thing. It definitely
we were covering up the bottom half, not the top half.
As opposed to the top half.
Right.
And that's a thing that I think about like AI facial recognition and stuff. The fact that facial recognition could still sort of work even when you had a mask on, because it mostly is in the eye.
It's looking at your bone structure of, again, the
cheekbones and eye shape.
Distance between your inner parts of your eyes versus your shape of your nose, and right? True.
And like that's the kind of stuff that's actually a lot more recognizable. Because I found that it was definitely an adjustment period at first because you weren't able to see people's whole face.
Right.
But that was the thing is, once you sort of learned how to make that adjustment in your brain, it wasn't hard.
Right.
And it then became this is what is recognizable about a person, and it's the things that had been recognizable about before, just with sort of a different filter.
The other thing for me on the other side of that was that I realized how much body shape, posture, some of those elements also worked to tell from across a hallway at church that I recognize that person. It's not that I'm seeing their face, but I recognize them.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing their face or not.
Stance.
I see
body
exactly.
Shape.
Yep. Gait. All of those things we don't notice.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for a costumed identity to work, you would have to work really hard at changing all of those things, all of those really natural things, which I think makes it tough. But I just thought that was an interesting way of thinking about, you know, we've had an experience of not really trying to disguise ourselves, but at least having some of our, maybe not our superhero masks, but our Lone Ranger masks.
Yes.
Other types of masks, perhaps.
So I'm not sure that the concept of the secret identity passed inspection for me. I was already biased, I will confess, on this topic to not to struggling with it in the real world.
I will say the thing that I have learned that is sort of my internal bias towards secret identities, again, a thing that I have learned in the past because of this mask experiment, but then also like getting back into work and working in retail and being around strangers again, I have discovered that I might actually be face blind is what I have learned. So that was my sort of realization of like, well, yeah, of course, like if you covered up elements of person, you'd never be able to recognize them. Then I've realized mostly within the last about 9 months. Hang on a second.
I don't recognize them anyway.
I don't think that that might not actually be quite as universal as I personally seemed to think it was. It is a thing that I have now had to bring up a couple of times. Because, again, as I'm doing more things and getting responsibilities and stuff, I have had people sort of asking my opinions of things and being like, hey, so if you see this person, if you recognize this person, and I have slowly had to admit to more and more people, I don't think I can do that, actually. I definitely, more than once, had my colleagues take off their glasses, and I did not recognize them. If they had no glasses and yes, mask, or vice versa, that was embarrassing.
I can certainly see, again, this idea of sort of understanding clothing, posture, gait, all of those intangible elements, I could buy with a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
What I learned through COVID.
Yeah.
I would recognize you. I'd recognize your mom. There are not millions, but dozens of people. Yeah,
a solid 25 people.
That I would recognize, even if they were wearing Batman's cowl and talking like that. So I think among close friends, it would be difficult to pull off, which may be why we've had the trend of moving away from secret identities, or at least many, many more people knowing. Part of that might be a television and movie trope and the actor wanting their fame. I mean, you sort of all, again, you have your Doyleist reasons and then coming up in story with a Watsonian explanation. But it's certainly most of the superhero TV shows, there is a core, and it's not just one or two people. It's a team of sometimes over
seven, eight, ten.
Yeah, pushing a dozen. Who know the secret identity. And in some cases, there isn't even a secret identity there at all. They've disposed of that in much of the MCU.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows Steve Rogers. Everyone knows who Black Widow. Everyone, Tony Stark. The end of the first movie.
Yeah.
Is the MCU saying, we're going to move away from secret identities.
For all that the Green Lantern movie was flawed, I gotta say, like, genuinely, it was one of the first ones to really sort of poke a little bit of a suspension of disbelief sort of hole. You really think that because you're wearing a mask when I have seen you naked, when I know you personally, that I'm not going to recognize you because you're wearing a weird outfit? Which is actually a pretty fair thing to bring up.
Yeah, I think it was because your cheekbones are covered.
Yeah, you're wearing a strip of bacon over your cheekbones. You think I can't recognize you?
Lots of things wrong with that movie.
Yes.
That was a right thing.
I agree.
Yes.
And I do like the idea there of it's like people who know you would know you.
Yes.
And it's sort of why the idea of the secret identity in the two separate identities between the people who know me in my private life and the people who still know me in my superhero life, I think that that's probably the element of the secret identity that has definitely gone away the most. There is not the Lois Lane knows and is very closely related with both Superman and Clark Kent without knowing they're the same person.
Yes.
That has gone largely by the wayside, that it's a person who interacts with both the civilian and the super identity is aware.
Right.
And I do like that. That's actually one of my things I really enjoy about like the Superman comics and the Batman comics is the idea, like you were talking about with like the team, it's the Bat family. That there is the close-knit group who is involved either from the civilian or the super identity side knows. there is that knowledge in between that group of people that it's like, well, these are not people that I would be able to hide that from. They would figure it out.
On the Superman and Lois TV show, this was recently brought up, not with the Superman character, but one of their sons has developed superpowers. And he doesn't have a costume or a mask. He was out saving something, and his grandfather, General Sam Lane,
yes,
called him in for a brief chat and, you know, had some pictures. And, you know, the kid said, no, but they didn't catch my face. You know, I made sure of that. And he looks at the character, and the actor has very poofy, curly hair. The general points at him and says, that hair is easily identifiable. This whole scene takes place in front of a barbershop, which is where the general has taken his grandson and saying, with the idea that, you know what you need, son? You need a buzz cut. Because there may only be one person with your exact hair, but there are about 30 million with the haircut that you're going to have in a few minutes.
In about 4.5 minutes.
By the way, General Sam did not go through with it. Talked out of it briefly. But again, I was thinking about that in terms of, you know, depending on the type of costume, and we're not specifically talking costumes, but you can't talk costumes without identity. So I call them costumed identities. If your hair is visible in the costume, which it is in many of our superhero costumes, that's another potentially very identifiable feature, especially, not to engage in stereotyping, especially on a male who on average changes their hairstyle once per lifetime.
Yes. This is why I want to take a moment and say Batwoman is the best costume and the best secret identity for this exact reason. Because a lot of costumes, I think, again, we're going to be jumping back and forth between the Watsonian and the Doyleist, and we're also going to be jumping back and forth between the idea of the secret identity and the idea of the costume.
Right.
It's why Batwoman's costume is one of the best costume designs, because a lot of costume designs sort of go with the idea of concealing.
Right.
Hers doesn't. Hers is all about, yes, look at me, this extremely tall woman in jet black with bright red long hair. And then she takes off the cowl and has a buzz cut.
That is
the kind of really solid costume design that I think is way more effective. Things that involve distraction in the costumed side as opposed to the private identity side of things. So Superman's glasses get mocked a lot. And I will say, justifiably. But Superman, I think, is actually a really good example of how to do what you were talking about well. Because Superman's costume is less about what he looks like and is more about how he stands. That's one of those examples that where I think it really does work well. And it's why I think that the Superman secret identity thing has endured as long as it has. But I like they have, again, disposed of that largely with his close friends, family, and cast. That is not a thing that would work on them. But the idea that Superman, the way that Superman stands, acts, breathes, moves, is so fundamentally different from the way that Clark Kent stands, breathes, acts, moves, that it's the personality and the behavior that is more of a costume than the actual costume.
Right.
It's why I also like any time that the costumed identity has the face exposed or the hair exposed, because it sort of presupposes this idea of the superhero version is the real version.
Right.
I feel like it's actually a lot easier to hide yourself if yourself is the not interesting one.
Right, right. If we go with the modern version, I'm mostly talking about the male characters here, but the huge, the muscle-bound, the jacked characters. If you're in that stereotype, if you're working on a farm and you got overalls, you got baggy jeans, you got an oversized flannel shirt and a trucker's cap, you can disguise some of your physical attributes in that sense. I like that. But as you were mentioning,
But I will say, Flyboy Hal Jordan looking that jacked means Flyboy Hal Jordan is going to the gym literally like 6 hours a day, and that's gonna actually be pretty noticeable.
Fair, it's fair. Of course, when you were talking about Batwoman, I, of course, go back to an earlier era. Two words, fake afro. Black Lightning. Boom. Now that was a costumed identity. Same idea. Black Canary wearing the wig. That's the different color.
Mm-hmm.
Same idea, because that it's a matter of thinking about what attributes are easily changed and concealed and which are more difficult to change or conceal. But like you say, when you see big flowing hair, our first thought is probably not wig. Our first thought might be, okay, that's what the person looks like.
Mm-hmm. And it's a sort of like setting an expectation.
Mm-hmm.
It's the hearing hooves and not thinking zebras. You know,
right,
it's
what's the first thing that, right.
In a way, using Occam's razor.
Right. What's the easiest?
Of course, I'm not wearing platform boots and fake hair. That would be absurd. But if you can distract people from the fact that you're wearing platform boots and have fake hair, no one's going to be looking for a 5'7" woman in a buzz cut.
Yeah.
They're going to be looking for a 6'2" woman with long red hair down to her butt, which is something that would be pretty easily identifiable.
Now let me turn us one direction a little bit and get a little Watsonian, a little inside, a little 21st century. We've talked about facial recognition. Every year that goes by, it gets tougher to beat.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about the secret identity in terms of the job, in terms of that element, which we have for a number of reasons. One, from the authorial perspective, is it gives you a built-in cast of characters.
Yes.
Superman books in the 90s, that Diamond era. From crisis to crisis era, considered some of the best Superman books. And part of it was because of the involvement of the extended cast, including the entire Daily Planet crew.
Yeah.
I mean, we had very sizable B and C plots with Jimmy and with Perry White and Ron Troop, et cetera, et cetera. What would Spider-Man be without J. Jonah Jameson? It's hard to conceive. Right, of what that character would be like without those foils from their real life. That's the purpose of the secret identity that I have the hardest time arguing against in terms of the genre. That's a very important reason why that's needed. It does become tougher to maintain the suspension of disbelief every year that goes by. When you think about the social security number needed for the job, or the DNA, or the fingerprints, or all of the data that is collected about us by private businesses and the government, which might be why something like registration, you know, that plot point actually makes some sense to me. As often those proponents are the bad guys. Many cases, the way they're portrayed. To me, in a quote-unquote realistic world, that would almost have to be the case.
I remember that was always one of the superhero stories that you liked the most was Union Dues.
Yes.
Because it did sort of take that, instead of going from the narrative preconceptions of how a superhero works, it started with those preconceptions and sort of built up.
Yeah.
From them, as opposed to building down to them, where it was, no, you do actually have to have a job. You have to be part of an organization that does have direct oversight in order for this to function. And that was the baseline of that entire like
line of
world
story. Yeah,
and
those
system.
Those stories, yeah. We talk about our superheroes being adjuncts either to the military or to police.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those are large employment institutions with a few bits of rules and regulations and standards and practices, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think realistically that might be the way that they would be, organized.
Yeah.
Although in terms of the money side of it, every year that goes by, and this is going to be my next National Novel Writing Month, so nobody steal this idea.
Okay, we're putting it out here with a stamp on it.
Patreon superheroes. One of the reasons for the job is, how do you pay the rent? How do you live the life? Blah, 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 blah. Patreon-based superheroics. It eliminates the need of the secret identity, except maybe with the bank. I mean, again, there are a few places you have to do some things. We'd have to come up with a new digital currency, the Batcoin. Okay, it's probably already done.
It's probably already exists.
Sorry, I meant the LexCoin. We're probably going to have to do this in LexCoin. That's the problem.
Yep.
But with quote-unquote anonymous digital currency, direct payments, to me it's almost coming around where you could pull off the funding mechanism of the heroics in that way without the need necessarily of the secret identity.
Okay, maybe. See, I am so glad that you brought this up, because what you have mentioned there exactly is, I will just flat out say it, it's why I don't like the MCU, and why I have had beef to just sort of disinterest with the MCU for so long, because the MCU did this and started with the baseline of, if these people are going to have public identities and are going to be known and are going to collaborate with government agencies,
right,
and in a formal, legal, recognized capacity, there are things that are going to naturally be the result of it. And it is what it brings up, the superhero registration sort of, right, narratives and like questions of oversight and checks and balances and authority and stuff, which in like Captain America, the Winter Soldier, really interesting, really liked it, has a lot of really good meat on that narratively. But it's also a story that I am incredibly bored by. I cannot describe
yep,
how absolutely drop-dead boring I find anything that has to do with, well, in order to do this thing from a legal context or through the cooperation with an international agency, you're going to have to go through the connection to this. I cannot describe how uninterested I am in that entire narrative conception. I don't care. I don't like it.
Now, I think this is probably because you're fortunate enough to go to work with a small independent bookstore.
Yes, I am.
Which did not have a long and involved orientation process. I mean, can you imagine Wolverine going through the S.H.I.E.L.D. orientation process?
No!
Guy Gardner would not pass. Even if Kilowog was a supervisor, he would not get past the 90-day probation period.
There is no way he would make it through the baseline necessary background checks to even get the first level of clearance to walk onto a military base. Like, there is no way that these goobers can pull this off. And I will say, this is a thing about, like, suspension of disbelief. That is so much harder for me to suspend my disbelief about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the more specific you get into it, the harder it is for me to believe in any way, shape, or form that these people would not absolutely be in prison. That is very much like the direction, like the narrative pull that kind of conception has. That I'm like, there's no way this would work. It's why I'm so glad that you brought up the internet thing, because back 45 to 65 to 90 years ago, it was so much easier to come from nowhere and have a separate private life. Because if you just lived in another state, nobody could check up on you. You're just like, oh yeah, I was in Kansas for 4 days. Literally nobody can check that. What are you going to do? Call his mom, collect? How are you going to find out where Clark Kent has been? He said, I was in Kansas. And you go, well, it's 1948 and I legitimately don't have a way to confirm that. I can't track that. Internet anonymity.
That is tough to pull off.
Is difficult to pull off, but what you brought up there is if you care less about the mechanics of living in a society, anonymity on the internet is actually a lot easier. Still difficult and getting harder in certain ways.
But easier in others in terms of drone delivery of your supplies, that in your food. Would you have to go out in public? Would there be a face that's recognized?
I mean, honestly, let's bring this back to TMNT. Honestly, TMNT in the 80s and the 90s was so like absurd and ridiculous. How could there be people that were like mutant turtles that existed in society? In 2023, I have no way of knowing if the people four houses down from me are mutant turtles or not. I literally never see them. Things like Uber Eats, delivery services, online processing have actually made it easier for you to not interact with society in the same way that we used to.
Right, yes.
I am not going to steal your Patreon superhero idea, but that's an example. PayPal has its own credit card now.
Right.
There are banks that are purely digital, which with a little bit, again, the more you get into the minutiae and the finites of how a thing mechanically works within the actual real world of registration of social security number of bank code, that stuff gets a little hairy. But with a little bit of wiggle room on that side, it could be pretty easy to get a fake credit card that is literally just a bank card that connects to Chime, that connects to Patreon. And provided you're making $500 a month, you're still doing better than most people who drive for Uber Eats for a living. So that is a thing that has become somewhat plausible in the modern context.
Okay, now I've got a name for my National Novel Writing Month novel.
Yes?
Only Heroes.
Oh, that's good!
Specifically, one-to-one crowdfunded superhero activities. Boom.
Dang, that's good. Dang, that's good. Because, again, to tie this into the internet, because we're going to take a step back again. The whole point about the superhero genre is that it is escapist in some way.
Yeah.
And that it also it's a response to current social climates. That as things change in society, the nature of the type of story that you tell within the context of the superhero genre changes. It's like horror that way.
Right.
Where it responds a lot to the social anxieties and like changes that are happening in the real world. As far as the way that Batman is perceived versus a terrifying vigilante versus best friend of the police commissioner versus one man army versus socialite philanthropist. Like all of those things are true simultaneously, but as far as which one is
we
most
focus on.
Focused, you know, that changes over time.
True.
And a lot of that has to do with what the real world feels like and what feels like a reasonable amount of suspension of disbelief.
I don't remember the way that this goes, but there was a legend that within the horror realm, and I really can't remember which way it goes, but theoretically in the U.S., when liberal politicians are in ascendance, we get zombie movies or vampire movies. I can't remember which one. And when conservatives are in ascendance, we get the others. They reflect what we fear most about. That is a theory that, you know, within U.S. pop culture, that what we're seeing, what we're anxious about, and how that comes out in creative work.
People have talked a ton about like the Skrull and the Red Scare. Any sort of social change in response in the way that superheroes then double down on the genre conventions or try to reinvent the genre convention. But it's like the 1980s, the latchkey kid anxiety and the rise of slashers, kids home alone, where technology was starting to move in such a way that it was a little bit isolating, but also new and strange and different. So many things about the 1980s slasher movies and then the way that they were sort of like reinterpreted and lampooned with like Scream says a lot about the way that people view telephone technology. And that kind of thing is going on simultaneously, basically all the time with superheroes. because it's a question of, well, what is a reasonable suspension of disbelief and what is a reasonable, like, what makes me feel safe, secure, or familiar is this person having a large cast of characters that all knows who they are versus this character being a solitary figure who is keeping a secret from the people around them.
Right.
And that ebbs and flows. And I think we're very much, again, in part because of because of COVID, we're very much the last like decade has been the rise of the found family.
That fictive kin.
The fictive kin. I'm so glad you remember that.
You took the sociology classes.
Yes.
I paid for them.
You know that.
So I paid attention as well.
You know what? You got me there. I was thinking about Blue Beetle, which is going to be the next big superhero thing that's going to be coming from DC. And I'm very excited about. Again, I don't find a lot of things that superhero movies are doing right now to be interesting. Because I find them to either be reiterating a story I already know, or taking the genre conventions in a direction that bores me.
Right.
And I'm just like, none of this is of interest to me. Blue Beetle, though, is of interest to me. And I think that one of the things that's interesting about it is that his entire family is in on it. And that's been the thing about the Jaime Reyes Blue Beetle as opposed to the Ted Kord Blue Beetle. And even just that generality, Jaime Reyes has been a part of DC continuity for like 30 years? Something like that. Which sort of says something about how slow the like kind of perception of the superhero genre like moves, that it's like, yeah, he's been here for 30 years, but he's still the new kid on the block.
He's the new guy, the new one.
But Ted Kord is very much the, like, I personally have been gifted this power and ability and responsibility and burden that I have to keep to myself in order to keep my family safe. Whereas Jaime Reyes is the, without my family, I don't have the support to do what I need to do. Yeah. I need people in order to make this work. I think that's sort of an interesting distinction when it comes to the secret identities. A thing that we had talked about in our notes about this, which somebody had brought up, again, 7 years ago when this first this episode was first conceived, was that it's not so much that it's a secret identity. It's not that necessarily that you're lying to people, and especially in this case, your friends and family, they know. It's your private identity.
Yes, right,
it's
right.
Other people don't have, hilariously, it's about setting boundaries. It's about, hi, people are not actually entitled to Superman's time, and Superman is not ethically required to always be on call just because he is the only Superman. And the idea that the secret identity is less about a secrecy than it is about privacy.
Right, yes.
I think is...
I think that's a cool distinction, valuable distinction.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes the secret identity really work. It's the you taking a break. It's you walking into the back room and stretching your back. Like having a chance where you are not being watched. Which again, in our current modern society, where you, as what you're talking about, where there is a lot of data collection, there is a lot of anxieties about what if somebody on the bus is just filming me on TikTok and I have no idea. The idea of having that privacy that you personally are very dedicated in preserving because this is your time with your family and your friends where you are safe means a lot. And in a way is a little bit of a throwback. Not to bring up our favorite problematic story of all time, Identity Crisis.
Yep.
Because it's about, yes, protecting your family, but also having a space where you are safe. And it's why Identity Crisis is so moving to us, because it's about that safety being violated. Like, what happens when the superheroes no longer feel safe?
Again, one of the things I like about Identity Crisis, and look, starting a sentence with that, you know, I know.
It's always a little, it's a good, yes, we know.
I know.
We know.
I know. Is that it took that question seriously.
Yes.
We had said for 50 years, I have to keep my private life private because it puts my friends and family at risk. And Meltzer said, yes, Let's tell the story of what happens when that fails, when that part of the fundamental part of the genre, when it fails. What's the worst thing that could happen? And yes, that's what he delivered. We know. We know. At this point, there are a couple of roads we could go down that let's cut them off. Shapeshifters and aliens.
Yes.
Okay, that obviously would change everything. Even if we limited ourselves to human beings. This is one of the ones, this may have been something that you said that annoyed you with this, but you really would have to look at the laws. And that's one thing that drives me crazy, is when we have a superhero universe where, in an attempt to be realistic, they're dealing with our current, our world laws. I'm sorry, Spider-Man can't testify in court.
Nope.
He wears a full body suit.
Yes.
Theoretically, there'd be no DNA to identify who is in the suit. There's not a finger to fingerprint to verify, much less anyone with the body type could be testifying in court. And if you're talking about law enforcement stuff, you actually want to do the court stuff right.
Yes.
To me, that's even more important structurally, societally, than the police stuff, as important as that is. You got to get the court stuff correct.
That's the thing. I love Daredevil. I love Daredevil so much. Because in my mind, what's interesting about that is the fact that he is upholding the law by day and breaking the law by night. And the fact that that is not the central convention of Daredevil stories more often makes me really upset. And the reason is because if you actually, again, if you do what Meltzer did and take it seriously, if you take Daredevil seriously in that context, again, you end up with everybody in prison. Like, the Marvel Cinematic Universe collapses in on itself. It is the little pinprick of the tiny black hole in the middle of reality that just sucks everything in. And the
all
whole
of
universe
them are
collapses
in, prison.
In
all
on
of
it.
Them are in
all
prison.
All of them. It doesn't
all
matter.
All the time.
All of them. And I'm like, that's what really gets to me. Because I'm like, that is the thing. And they've done it a couple of times of, like, Daredevil on trial, Spider-Man on trial, stuff like that. And I'm just always like, it doesn't hit right because that should actually be the biggest worst thing that could happen to you, because that is when the whole house of cards comes crumbling down. As soon as you get caught there, you're just boned. Because again, you have written in a universe in which current American legal proceedings still exist.
Right.
Those two things are things that are going to be fundamentally opposed to each other, which is not a problem. But it annoys me when those things are not simultaneously taken seriously.
No, look, I think we've said this before, but at Arkham Asylum and Blackgate Penitentiary, mm-hmm. I am sure that the revolving doors uh-huh. were an interesting design feature.
Yes.
I'm just saying they might not be the most practical. Not every state in the U.S. has a death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them do. I'm sure some of these crimes have taken place in death penalty jurisdictions. All of our villains are mass murderers.
Let's start with that.
All of our sympathetic villains are mass murderers.
Mm-hmm.
All of our anti-heroes are mass murderers. And some of our heroes are, at best, guilty of
negligent
homicide all the time.
Yes.
And I think that is why when some bad guys become popular, they move them to sympathetic villain, perhaps even to anti-hero, occasionally to hero. Because whether it's Punisher or Deathstroke or Harley Quinn or Deadpool, whoever it is, those are blood-soaked hands that those characters have. It's why some of them, I believe, end up becoming, as part of their storyline, end up becoming agents of the state. In terms of, we will use your power of killing for good. Here is the presidential immunity.
Yeah.
Here's the pardon for everything that you've done before.
Because again, from a Doyleist perspective. There is no other way for this story to go. You have essentially written yourself into a corner by saying that you need to stay true to the internal logic of how this would be perceived from the outside world.
Now you could
just say negatively, very, very negatively.
Now you could do this in a miniseries. You could do this in one-off. You could do this in an independent where your quote-unquote hero is either killed at the end or executed appropriately. But if you're doing an ongoing 80-year soap opera storyline and selling merch,
it's yes, a disconnect.
Yes, there is Venom merch. Yes, there's Deadpool merch. Yes, there's Punisher merch. But if you're going to sell that stuff, you have to give some recognition to the facts of the case, and then you have to deal with that within the story somehow. And to me, that's sort of where the secret identity fails, because all of these guys are on the wrong side of the law in one way or another at one time or another. I mean, there is a joke. You know, on average, we all commit 3 felonies a day, which I think is why we also often have the trope within the genre of the best friend who is on the police force, a connection. Batman needs Commissioner Gordon for many, many reasons, mostly to cover up all his crimes.
Yes.
that's the main reason.
That's the big one. To say, don't prosecute Batman. Why? Because we need Batman. But then the second question is then, why? Answer is because he's significantly more competent than the rest of the Gotham Police Department. But also, the way that he does it is illegal.
But that is what I like about She-Hulk and Daredevil. When they handle legal cases, at least make nods in that direction. The She-Hulk TV show was great at that, in terms of mocking some of the tropes, including mocking the legal tropes within stories like this. But again, I think that's where a lot of these guys end up in one way or another on a government payroll somewhere.
Yeah.
And at that point, that pretty much is going to include a fingerprint and a social security number and some of the things that make living off the grid fully pretty hard. I think that's also why they all nowadays need not just the guy in the van, the girl in the cave, but they need a team of high-tech folks to cover for them. One of the geniuses of stumbling into putting, you know, Barry Allen in the police department. That was a good idea.
Yeah.
He can cover up his own evidence.
Yes.
That's one of the most important things that a superhero has to do, I think. I love my science fiction. I love my fantasy, whether it's prose or whatever, but I do kind of like my crime fiction and my detective stories too, and I like those because they sort of almost are taking place in the real world. And I wouldn't mind it if my comic books, again, at least I like when they nod to the real world and how non-viable some of this stuff is.
Because as we were talking here about a lot that has to do with legality, I have been getting a lot into D&D and Dungeons and Dragons and stuff, Pathfinder and whatever. And one of my perpetual soapboxes that I'm on these days is there is a reason that the alignment chaotic good exists.
Right.
And that's sort of like where it comes into with my superhero fiction is that, again, in a miniseries or something like that, like I can find that really interesting to do some like more gritty crime procedural style stuff. That sort of stuff popping up in Identity Crisis. I really liked it because it was a miniseries. And again, I brought up Batwoman. Batwoman is great about this. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when you really dig into like detective-y stuff and some elements of the Marvel Universe where this is written well.
Right.
I think it gets trotted out as a whitewash brush a little bit too often to say, well, we're doing this realistically. And even that, it's a caricature of realism.
Right.
It is a caricature of the legal system. It's a caricature of having a public and a private persona. It's a caricature of how the police force works, or of how the United States or UN handles international incidents. I find it to be more often than not a cop-out.
Mm.
And again, just one that kind of tends to bore me, unless you're actually really good at it. If you're really good at it, then I'll be interested. Because it's good, and you know what you're talking about. This is why I want, like, actual lawyers
right.
writing Daredevil books. Because I think that would be great. But the idea of the superhero as an inherently chaotic thing...
That's interesting.
...is a thing that I feel like has been largely lost. Mm. Like, it sort of got brought up more in the 90s, where it was all very much about the anti-hero and the anti-establishment and taking down the man and whatever. Which I was like, cool, neat, awesome. But a lot of cases, like you mentioned, Punisher and stuff, it was mostly just kind of an excuse to just be violent.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, I also find kind of boring. But the idea, I'm going to be thinking about Only Heroes for like months until November. When I'm just going to come out of the woodwork in your house and be like, so, when you going to get on an outline for that one, buddy? The idea of a superhero as an inherently chaotic thing is a thing that we've sort of lost a little bit. That's the kind of stuff that I personally find interesting. That's what I find validating. It's like, I live a law-abiding, pretty boring life 85% of the time.
And 85% of the time, you make your father very proud.
Thank you. The inherent chaos behind being an actual vigilante, being like, yeah, this is not a thing that is actually approved of, sanctioned, sometimes wanted. That's kind of the appeal of the superhero story. And it's certainly worth bringing up then when that comes into conflict.
Yeah.
It's also why, like, a lot of times with things like the Avengers, where it's like, it gets too big.
Right.
The bigger the thing gets, the more complicated it becomes, the more often you're going to be bouncing up against these, like, real world or caricatured versions of real world restrictions.
And I know. It's escapist. I understand that. Guess that I read in a lot of genres. Medieval fantasy. Go wild. Sci-fi. Go wild. I will even let you violate some rules of astrophysics within my sci-fi. Some sci-fi fans, nope, nope, never, never, never. But I was thinking even Westerns or noir. I kind of let those genre conventions exist. And I think part of it is because they're not pretending it's the real world. It's not pretending to be...
The world outside your window.
The world outside your window. It's not intending or pretending to be that. And I think that's where I struggle a little bit with some of these. Bob Haney, you go crazy with whatever plot you want to tell. But when you violate some of these structural or, again, sort of legal or societal things, it's like, oh, no, he can't. That's against the law with that hero. That was breaking and entering. That is gathering evidence that will be thrown out of court.
Absolutely immediately. That is not viable.
Because that's the way a justice system actually should work. It should work against vigilantism. Against some of Batman's... Okay.
Most.
Say what you want to about any version of the Supreme Court. I think your 9 least favorite justices... From whatever side you're on in the history.
Nobody's going to let that fly.
a confession that involves being hung by your toes from a gargoyle 77 stories up. Probably not going to stand up in any court of law. So, I mean, we all have our lines where we have to work harder to get by in our disbelief. Some of that is incredibly personal in terms of, like, the things that you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to our friend Dr. Ange about this. Some medical stories, no problem at all. Some, I'm not saying he
throws it across the room, but I think it crosses his mind at times. Or Paul Spatero about some of this legal stuff. You and I have in the past, on this very show, I believe, talked about the Drew Hayes
series. I'm so glad you mentioned Fred the Vampire Accountant. Your favorite, your most validating scene representative character in all of speculative fiction.
Fred the Vampire Accountant. Because, look, I don't know if the vampire elements of that story are true and accurate, but the accounting, the business valuation, the taxes, those are right on. And not Professor Allen approved. Professor Middleton approved.
The guy with the master's in business management and economics.
That I will pass the Fred the Vampire Accountant books.
But full thumbs up on that one.
But when that stuff is done, not just a little bit, but sloppily, that's, oh, come, what are you doing? What are you doing? And for some reason, I feel that way, I think, to some extent, about Secret Identities and some of this legal stuff. It's like, you don't have to deal with the situation in the way that I would approve. Recognize that it's a situation. Deal with it some way, then you have me on board.
Yes. Recognize that it is a conflict. Again, yeah. To snap back to the Doyleist,
right.
That is part of the inherent conflict of your genre. And if you're avoiding it, a little bit is, well, then what's the point? I think that what you're bringing up there specifically is it's why I like DC Comics generally as a right. property, as a universe, as a place. I find that the place where I settle in more because they have wizards. There are wizards. If you have introduced wizards, it is no longer a crime drama. It is a fantasy narrative. And if it's a fantasy narrative, I can buy a lot of stuff because you have wizards. There are talking monkeys. Starfish. You do not try to make any of that stuff make any shred of logical sense. But I can buy it if you just say, this is a world with space wizards and Nazis from parallel dimensions who can shoot laser beams out of their eyeballs. I'm like, cool. I don't live in that world. So I don't have to pretend to understand how the legal system there works.
You had me at talking monkeys.
I know. I've always got you at talking monkeys.
Because you know it's not a DC podcast till the super smart talking ape show up. Talking monkeys. Yeah, fair enough.
Like, that's the thing. In my mind, the Marvel Universe are crime stories. And a lot of them, I think, are really sloppy.
DC is mythic hero mythic fantasy?
Urban fantasy, sci-fi nonsense. And as a result, I don't mind the rules of reality being caricatured. Because again, there is a 37 story tall woman whose name is Giganta who is dating a monkey. Like, that's cool. Great. Awesome. Again, that is the opposite end of Union Dues.
Right.
Where Union Dues was, let's start with this as the premise and build up. Where DC Comics says, here is some weird garbage. Accept it. This is going to be your baseline. We'll go from there. Everything that comes down to genre conventions is what sorts of things are fundamental to the story. And I don't think that the superhero identity is fundamental. Because you absolutely can tell superhero stories that don't have secret identities. It's more likely to be a superhero story that I'm not interested in. I don't care about Tony Stark. And I have never cared about Tony Stark. I do like Captain America, but the more you talk about Steve Rogers, the less I care. I like him as a dude, and I like Captain America as a dude. But when you take him and put him, again, into conflict with the real world, I get very bored. Very fast.
Interesting.
Because this is no longer a fun, zany fantasy, And it's probably also not a particularly well-written crime story. Like, that's what's so great. It's why I brought it up. Like, Winter Soldier is so good. Mm-hmm. Because Winter Soldier, the original story, was built precisely on this thing. Was saying, hey, can we take a moment and talk about how Bucky died? Like, a kid died. And we've never given that seriousness. Mm-hmm. That I'm interested in. That's got pathos. That's got, you know, meaning behind it. And then the film version was, let's tell a spy thriller that has Captain America in it. And I was like, heck yeah. Because that is a world and a setup and people writing a spy thriller. That's really freaking good.
Yeah.
It's when you try to slap the spy thriller stuff onto a superhero movie that's not actually a spy thriller. And thus, the superhero is not going to be done well and the spy thriller isn't going to be done well. This is just some sort of weird chimera that I'm not really going to care about. I'm not going to be invested. Because all I'm going to see are the places where those two things are bopping into each other and poking holes in each other's suspension of disbelief. You got to suspend something, but you can't really suspend everything.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing about genres. They exist to deliver certain types of stories to their faithful, loyal readers in what is and is not part of that genre. What falls inside and outside is debatable. I've got some old sci-fi magazines that I've been reading recently, you know, 50s and 60s, and the debate of hard sci-fi versus space opera.
Oh, yeah.
Is that stuff really sci-fi? And of course, don't get us started on the fantasy. I believe it was our good friend, the Irredeemable Shag.
Oh, dear.
Who recently posted a picture with his kid, bookstore or a library, proudly pointing to the two signs, science fiction and fantasy.
And ne'er the twain shall meet.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, we have an idea of what superhero stories are. But I think it's a legitimate conversation. I think it's debatable as to how important, intricate, inherent into the genre is the secret identity. And I like the idea of dealing with it, perhaps dispatching it. I don't need it in every one of my stories. Put it that way.
Taking a good amount of this episode to just crap on the MCU. I'm sorry. I try not to be a hater, but I don't like it. I don't need Captain America to have a secret identity. Captain America, especially as he is now, the man out of time, is right. already so disconnected from the world he came from mm-hmm. that it doesn't make sense for him to try and become invisible.
It was in some version of a Cap story that I saw. Sure, it was Cap. It may have been another Man Out of Time story. I think it was Cap who went to the Defense Department and collected his 57 years of back pay and automatic promotions and therefore didn't have to work. Didn't have to deal with the secret identity
stuff. See, that's brilliant. That's perfect. That's wonderful. And that works great for
yes.
Cap.
Yep.
If Superman ever got rid of his secret identity, I would absolutely hate it. That would be inviolate because so much of what Superman is tied up into the idea of could be anyone in a mm-hmm. sort of way.
Right.
It's a Superman is an idea that's largely disconnected to the person of Clark Kent, but they are both admirable heroes.
Right.
But they represent such different things and such different types of heroism that the stories would fall flat
right.
if you didn't have both sides of that coin. To say something that is, like, nigh blasphemous to people who really love the MCU.
Oh, boy.
Hate Smart Hulk. Why would you do that? Because you have violated the convention of the Hulk story, which is the Jekyll and Hyde. If he is no longer split between the scientist and the brute, I am no longer interested. You have violated not just the genre, but you violated the point of the character.
If you make Hulk smart, isn't he just a Gorilla Grodd ripoff? Boom, it all comes back to super smart talking monkeys.
If the super smart talking monkeys will inherit the Earth. I watched Planet of the Apes. Anyway.
Boom.
I know where this whole thing is going.
I think what we're saying is be open-minded. All kinds of scenarios regarding your secret identities. Let a thousand flowers bloom.
Yes.
I'm trying to end it positive as how much you just annoyed 87.5% of our listeners already.
That's fine. Again, you know, it's hot take central apparently over here. You can always come up with your Watsonian explanation for why they can't have a superhero identity, right. Why they have to have a superhero identity. What I think matters more is taking a step back and not going, well, it's a superhero story, so there's got to be a secret identity.
Right.
Or it's a superhero story, so there's got to be a costume. Taking that step back and being like, what's in service to the story? Mm-hmm. Not just the genre.
Right.
We're not trying to reinvent the wheel, necessarily. And if you do, then you have changed conventions of the genre, and that's when we get into splitting hairs about sci-fi versus space opera versus space wizards. Again, but, it all comes back to wizards.
But are you using your secret identity to forward the main plot, to develop a supporting cast of characters, to introduce friendships, relationships, love interests, antagonists, mm-hmm. all these other elements that you're going to use well within the story or not?
And are you going to take it, maybe not seriously, but are you going to think about the ramifications?
Yeah.
Are you going to maybe not take the concepts seriously, but are you going to take the conflict seriously?
Right.
If this creates conflict between interpersonal relationships, because how dare you not tell me that you're doing this dangerous thing? How can you be keeping me safe if I don't know this thing about you? That's a great conflict. If it's, I have to wear this superhero costume and do this thing because what I'm doing is illegal, that's a conflict. That's a cool conflict. I want to know more about that. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing it? What is the conflict? What is the difficulty there? That's where the story happens.
Handle it, acknowledge it, address it.
And know what you're doing. Do it on purpose.
And listeners, if you have any comments on anything we've said today,
we would love to hear from you about it.
So if you want to share your comments on this episode, or, and we mean it, any prior episodes, we would love to hear from you.
You can send email to relativelygeeky@gmail.com or put a comment on the blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com.
Are we experts on the law?
No.
Are we experts on, I don't know, anything we've talked about today?
I don't really think so. Except for the accounting part, you actually have...
I'll give you a nod on sociology. Okay, other than those things, remember, as we talk about any of these topics, as we count ourselves down to the final showcase, remember, we're not experts.
We're just family. If the MCU has taught us anything, it's
post-credit scene.
Yes. So let's have a post-credit scene.
After show content.
We should definitely have an after show because I also didn't bring up my favorite superhero secret identity, and we're going to get to that in the after show.
I want to talk about my two favorite world's greatest detectives.
Yes.
Batman and Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
And how much they have in common.
Yes.
They both have a Robin.
Yes.
They both have a Mrs. Hudson.
Yes. Okay, but let me just say, only one of those Mrs. Hudsons has a gun. And it's Alfred Pennyworth.
You don't know Mrs. Hudson.
Okay, I don't, clearly.
Okay, you're probably right.
That's the Holmes adaptation I want to see. Mrs. Hudson has a gun.
They both have a Catwoman. Both have a Moriarty. They both have many Matches Malones.
And several Irene Adlers.
Several Irene Adlers. Why does Batman need a secret identity and Sherlock Holmes does not? They do, more or less, the exact same thing, including threatening and beating up bad guys to get confessions.
Yes.
There's a lot in common. Why does Holmes not need a secret identity and Batman needs a secret identity, quote unquote? Master of disguise, he could have had a secret identity.
Because honestly, it happens occasionally, but there should actually be a lot more criminal underworld people attempting to murder Sherlock Holmes.
And of course, also need to give a shout out to some of my favorite characters. Doc Savage.
Yes.
Challenge of the Unknown. Adam Strange.
Mm-hmm.
Characters who are just themselves. So the idea of living without a secret identity exists even within the comic book world.
Mm-hmm. Here's your genre distinction, which, dang, so mad this is going to be in the after show. Whatever, bonus content. What you have touched on right here is a distinction between two of my favorite genres. None of those people are superheroes. Those are adventure stories.
Yes, they are.
The dying genre of adventure story. Jennifer Nielsen is writing adventure stories, and let me just say, I am just so absolutely delighted. And it keeps getting put into fantasy young adult. And I'm like, it's not fantasy. It's adventure. There's no magic. There's no wizards.
But you don't have a room for adventure. I mean, you don't have a department for adventure stories.
I wish,
though. There aren't enough of them.
There aren't enough. They get lumped in with other things. Tintin's an adventure story.
Yes.
Sherlock Holmes is an adventure story. Doc Savage, Adam Strange, Challengers of the Unknown, The False Prince. Those are all adventure stories.
True.
They're not fantasy stories and they're not superhero stories. And I'd say largely because they don't have wizards
or
they don't have secret identities.
You've cracked the case.
I think I've cracked the case.
You are now my third favorite world's greatest detective.
I was like, Watson, have I solved it?
Elementary, my dear M.
I just wanted to bring this up. There wasn't a good time for it necessarily, but I wanted to give a shout out for my favorite super identity, which is from the Latin American cartoon Cyber Six. I am frigging obsessed with this show. It is amazing. One of my favorite examples of superhero identity thing. Main character is a cyborg, a female cyborg who fights these cybernetic evil robots. It's very kind of Mega Man. Fights the monstrosities made by her creator by night, but by day has a male secret identity. Her superhero identity is big, tall, like cat suit woman with this sleek hair that's swooped up and like black lipstick and heavy makeup. And then the daily self is a high school teacher named Adrian who wears big, oversized, frumpy clothes and suspenders and a heavy oversized jacket and just straight up looks like Columbo. And I am obsessed with them. Literally
nice.
Top 10, like most character of all time. The beautiful, incredible, gender fluid, superhero, cyborg hero, Cyber Six. Go watch it on YouTube.